Well, what a joy to celebrate the blessing of the backpacks here this morning. It's back to school this week, and we're all happy. We're all excited about that, right? Well, on that note, let's turn to Psalm 13, a psalm of lament now this morning. Psalm of lament, because if we're honest, the fact that summer's almost over is a tragedy to many of us. Last week, we looked at Psalm 121, the traveler's psalm, and I love how Pastor Cindy was so honest that there are times in our lives where even its comforts seem to ring hollow. Times when God is with you sounds like a pious platitude, and God is watching over you sounds downright cruel. And times when he literally does let our foot slip, and in worse things than in pickleball. So what do we do in those times? Just chin up and bear it and say only nice kinds of stuff? I mean, where do we go with our feelings of sadness, hurt, and anger, abandonment, loneliness, and fear? Well, there is a place that the Bible shows us, and there is a language that God gives us to bear. Let's turn now to Psalm 13, a prayer of lament, an honest cry to God. For the director of music, a psalm of David. How long, Lord, will you forget me forever? How long will you hide your face from me? How long must I wrestle with my thoughts and day after day have sorrow in my heart? How long will my enemy triumph over me? Look on me and answer, Lord my God. Give light to my eyes or I will sleep in death. And my enemy will say, I have overcome him. My foes will rejoice when I fall. But I trust in your unfailing love. My heart rejoices in your salvation. I will sing the Lord's praise, for he has been good to me. Friends, this is the word of the Lord. Well, one of the problems in dealing with a text like this is that right now, at this very moment, we're not in the same place as the psalmist. After all, where are we? Well, we're in church. We come here, we sing happy songs with our families and friends. We rejoice in the promises of God. This just isn't a Psalm 13 kind of place. It's more of a Norman Rockwell kind of place. A happy place, a place of joy and of comfort. So when we approach a psalm like Psalm 13, a lament psalm, we first of all just have to admit it. We don't want to go there. We don't want to go there at all. That's why we rarely, if ever, sing the lament songs in our hymn books. That's why our pastors rarely, if ever, preach on them. Guilty as charged. But you know, there sure are a lot of these lament psalms in the Bible. About a third of the psalms, the church's prayer book, contain these bitter, angry, hurt-filled protests to God. So maybe God doesn't want us to ignore them anymore. Maybe we need them somehow. But where do we begin then? I mean, how do we sing a song like Psalm 13 here with David? It's one thing to sing one like Psalm 40 with him. I waited patiently for the Lord. He turned and heard my cry. He lifted me up out of the pit, out of the mud and mire. You too actually sings that one. But how do we sing Psalm 13? How long, Lord, will you forget me forever? How long will you hide your face from me? If you had to set Psalm 13 to music today, heavy metal or rage rap might be the best choice. Can you imagine a song like that in our hymn books? So to help us enter into this psalm here this morning, I want to begin on some ground that we all share. Stories. We all have some stories that go something like this. A kid is left sitting or standing on a curb, and you're that kid. Cars are whizzing by. Every once in a while, one pulls over, but it's never the right one. Classmates jump up and pile in. Your friends shout goodbye and head home, but there's no sign of your parents' car. And so you wait. You wait. You wait. You wait. Slowly you move from pacing around impatiently with both your backpack and your instrument case to setting your instrument case down in front of you, then setting down the backpack, and finally sitting down on one or both. But the movement is all downhill. Your back starts to ache, your shoulders slump, your jaw drops, your mouth starts to let out little groans. And finally you just sit there, chin in your hand, in your hands, too dejected to even look up anymore. Anger starts to boil at the injustice of it all. But soon you feel that being joined by something else, by fear. What's keeping them? Where are they? Did they just forget you again? How could they abandon you for so long here, all alone? Or maybe your story is about being ditched by your friends when they went to the beach last weekend. Or about your boss totally overlooking you and promoting a lazy coworker. But the gut feeling is the same in all of our stories. How could you? See, that's where David is at when he prays this prayer. This mix of helplessness and anger. It's just boiling in a pot of fear there. Boiling till it bursts forth in blame and in accusation. But if we're honest, David's pain goes even deeper than many of us have faced. The anguish here may be more like a man like Christian Rager's. Who is Christian Rager? Well, I want to share with you his story, his testimony this morning, as it's told by Philip Yancey in his book, Where is God When It Hurts? During World War II, Rager was a pastor in the Confessing Church in Germany. That meant he refused to obey Hitler's regime and was soon turned over to the Nazi authorities by his own church organist. They sent him to Dachau, a concentration camp. And there in that death camp, the smell of burning bodies and the constant fear that his would surely be next soon drove Rager to abandon all hope in a loving God. No good God could let such evil win. God had forsaken them. Once a month, though, each prisoner was allowed to receive a single letter from a loved one. Rager got one from his wife. Though it had been carefully clipped up and censored by the authorities, at the bottom of it she'd written a Bible reference, Acts 4:26-29. Rager read the verses in this Bible that he had smuggled away, but he didn't really get it yet. The rulers gather together against the Lord and against his anointed one, it said. Well, sure, he could understand that part. The Nazi authorities were just like Herod and Pilate of Jesus' day. But how could he understand the end of that verse, its explanation for God allowing such horrible things to happen? They did what God's power and will had decided beforehand should happen. How could that be? How could a good God let such evil happen in this world? How could there even be a God in the face of so much wrong? Rager, like so many others who went through the concentration camps, like so many others who have lived long in places of despair and oppression, Rager was in the place of Psalm 13. His enemy was exulting over him. He had pain in his own soul. Sorrow split his heart all day long, and the face of the Lord was hidden. Listen to David's complaint and see if you don't agree here. How long, Lord? Will you forget me forever? How long will you hide your face from me? How long must I wrestle with my thoughts and day after day have sorrow in my heart? How long will my enemy triumph over me? There are really three accusations or complaints that David makes here to God. The first in verse 1 is a you complaint, and it's directed straight at God. You forgot me. You turned your back on me, he cries. He's shaking his fist in desperation at the Almighty. And the second is an I complaint. I've suffered for so long, he groans. We find that in the first part of verse 2. David's thoughts have turned inward there to his own pain, his own angst and confusion. What's the point of suffering so much in this world? And the third complaint is a they complaint. It's at the end of verse 2. The enemy, they're winning, God, he says. So the totality of his life hangs in the balance here. His relationship with God, with himself, and with others. And God is to blame. We flinch at that, I know. But see, that is what David is saying. And he's not about to stop at complaints. No, he wants action. So in verse 3 to 4, David storms into God's throne room to make his requests, his demands. Look on me. Answer me. Give light to my eyes, God. Again, there are three of these. They follow directly from his three complaints. Pay attention to me. Give me health and strength. Defend me, God. He wants help. And he wants it now. He even goes so far as to give God a series of three ultimatums. Help me now, God, or else I'll die. My enemy will claim that they've killed me. And they'll rejoice in my death. This is serious talk, deadly serious, not nice. But what right does David have to think that God is going to answer to him? Does he really expect that the Almighty God, the great King of earth and heaven, should answer to him? His argument rests on this. If God does not help, he insinuates, it's God who will look like a failure. Before both him and before his enemies. Before him, because God will fail to uphold his covenant promises to his people. And before his enemies, because they'll claim victory over God. The truth of this begins to really sink in when we find out that in David's day, death was not just an impersonal or natural force, but that the Canaanites actually saw death as a person, as a god, as the god Mote. In essence, then, God is provoking his king to battle over a competing god here. Come on, God, are you really going to let Mote win? Prove yourself. Defend your glory and your honor. But to go so far, I mean, there must be a tremendous amount of pain, of anguish here, too, behind David's words. So much that he can't help but to lash out at God. Many scholars think David's lying on a sickbed here, near the point of death. Reports of the enemy's advances are being read to him, and he can't bear to hear all the news of the losses. It looks for all the world like God has abandoned him, forsaken his people, and forgotten all his promises. David's sick with fear. His closest neighbor now is death itself. He feels rejected, forsaken, forgotten. We think of when our own stories have taken us to such depths. A battle with cancer, a long winter of depression or loneliness, a prison of abuse or addiction, a grave of a loved one. How long can we endure it? How long can we stand the pain? An illness or injury that keeps us bedridden. A pink slip from higher management. A door slammed shut on our future hopes and dreams. A breakup that leaves our heart in pieces. Where is God when it hurts? How could he let this happen? Why won't he help? Why won't he answer? Doesn't he even care? Our questions are more than fair, friends. They're just. But back to Psalm 13. Does David get an answer here? There are only two more verses in this short but supercharged psalm. If these others have shocked you, well, these two will just astonish you. No straight answer from God, no, but something else. It's still David speaking, and still to God. But look what he says here next. But I trust in your unfailing love. My heart rejoices in your salvation. I will sing the Lord's praise, because he has been good to me. Wait, what? What happened? Has God answered? Has he acted? Has he cured David of his sickness? Has he saved him from all of his enemies? Well, maybe, but if so, David sure doesn't mention it. Instead, he simply says, I trust, directing that trust to three things, really. God's unfailing love, God's salvation, and God's goodness. And we're dumbfounded. How? David, how? Have you sold us out? Have you given up our protest? Have you gone crazy? How can we trust the God that we blame? That is the real question that throbs here at the heart of Psalm 13. How can we trust the one that we blame? Christian Rager learned to trust the one that he blamed. When last we saw him, he was in the depths, looking at that note that he had received from his wife, perplexed by that quote from Acts 4, 26 to 29, about how a good God could allow the rulers of the earth to do so much evil. But that same day, Rager had to undergo interrogation, the most terrifying experience in the camp. He'd be forced to name the names of other Christians in the confessing church outside. And if he gave in, those people would be captured, maybe even killed. But if he refused, he'd probably be beaten with clubs and tortured with electricity. As he waited outside the interrogation room, the door suddenly opened, and a man that Rager had never met quietly slipped something into his pocket. But before he could check what that was, Rager was called to go in. He made it through the interrogation, which went surprisingly well. He'd been lucky, he thought. No grave torture. Going back to his barracks, though, he tried to calm his quivering body down. Then he remembered that stranger. Looking in his pocket, he found a matchbox. But when he opened it, there were no matches, only a note. And neatly printed on that note was this reference, Acts 4, 26 to 29. It was exactly the same text that his wife had sent him. To Rager, a coincidence was unthinkable. He'd never met the man, and there was no way that a fellow prisoner could have seen his wife's letter. God had arranged this. It was living proof that God was still alive, still able to strengthen, still worthy of his trust. He hadn't rescued Rager, no, nor saved him from all his suffering. It simply assured Rager that he was alive, that he was there. And he knew that Rager was there too. So with this story in mind, listen to how Rager later explains his change of heart, his return to the faith. Nietzsche said a man can undergo torture if he knows the why of his life. But here at Dachau, I learned something far greater. I learned to know the who of my life. He was enough to sustain me then, and is enough to sustain me still. Can Rager's faith help us understand David's? How did David come to trust the God that he blamed? You know, maybe somewhere in that space between verse 4 and 5 here, God reached out and grabbed David, delivered him of all his troubles, healed his illness, drove away all his enemies. Or maybe God answered him with a quiet little note slipped to him by a priest like Rager. Or maybe not, but in the end you see it doesn't matter, because either way, David comes to the same one that Rager does, the same one who we must when we are drowning in despair. And Psalm 13 is all about that embrace. Look at it one more time. Who is the accusation pointed at? Yahweh. Who is the demand made to? Yahweh. Who is trusted and rejoiced in? Yahweh, the Lord. Three times David uses God's most personal name, and each time he can't help but grow closer to him. How long, Yahweh? He cries out in anger and despair in verse 1, but at least he's still talking to God. Look on me and answer, Yahweh, my God, he demands in verse 3. But notice he's even closer now. He says so with that little word, my God. I trust in Yahweh, whose love and salvation are unfailing, and I will sing of his goodness to me, he boasts in verse 5 and 6 here. His resolve to trust in God's promises based not on his own circumstances at all, but on who God is. And so even while David is screaming at God, the Lord has turned his heart. God met Rager in Dachau and David on a sickbed in the midst of battle. Where will God meet us? How can we trust the one that we blame? We've seen Rager and David move on to such trust, but how do we get there in our lives then? How do we let go and move on to that place? Well, there is one other we can all look to who asked this question. He suffered, he felt pain, he faced the ultimate abandonment, and he too cried out to his father, Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani, my God, why have you forsaken me? He stormed the gates of heaven with the same pain-filled questions we so often do. He did it too, and he was God. Jesus Christ, Emmanuel, God with us, God understanding us. In him, our trust is born. Let's go to him now. Lord, you are a big God, and you can take it. All our griefs and our grievances, all our hurts and our heartaches here in life. When we hold them in, we only grow hardened. When we take them out on others, we make them worse. But when we take them to you, Lord, somehow you turn our tears into trust. Forgive us, Lord, for forgetting how deep your love really goes. And forgive us for all our failures to lean on you in all our relationships with others. Hear now our silent prayers as we open up our hearts. Lord, have mercy. Hear our laments now. Lord, hear our cries.